Shall we start again? I think it's clear that like so many mystics in so little time, you know, we're kind of... the answer is not to start talking real fast to get all this in, because it's quite impossible even when we go slow, really. So we're bearing witness to something. And so I realize if we get a good... You know, it's like entering a river. No matter where you enter, you get just as wet. And the thing is to get good and wet. And it's Dan Walsh used to say at the monastery, I know it, I know it, I know that I know it. And the trouble is, though, it's I who know that I know it. And when I try to tell you what it is that I know that I know, I don't know what to say. Thomas Merton once said, there are certain things in life where we go crazy inside unless we just accept them as true. And they're the things we can't prove to anybody, including ourselves. But there is a kind of language that bears witness to the truth of what we cannot explain. And deep calls unto deep. And there's a recognition, a kind of visceral resonance with the intimacy of the unexplainable, which is contemplative church. Thomas Merton called this spiritual communication. It's language in the service of the unsayable. It resonates with us, and it opens up a longing within us. And once that's been achieved, then it flows on. It flows on. So I think that's the kind of language here. Does that make sense in a way what we're doing here? This applies also to deep therapy. They have a lot of therapeutic language. The healing language is this language. And therefore, as long as we're true to the spirit of it. So what I'd like to do is I'd like to continue on then in a very practical way. One more text by Merton. And maybe we could just look a little bit at maybe Teresa. The interior castle, and just maybe a little on the Dark Night, and we'll go up until 10 till 12, so we have 10 minutes for dialogue. Okay. Let's say this makes sense to you. In your heart it makes sense to you. And let's say more than makes sense to you, you're drawn to it. And let's say that so far what's understood is that to follow this path, you're to live your life. You've been given your life to live your life. And so you're to live your life with clarity as a conscientious, vulnerable, loving person each day. And your life's illumined by faith. There's a kind of an expansiveness in your heart. I'm going to say for most of us here, probably so within the Christian tradition. They might be here from other traditions, no tradition. But whatever tradition it's come through, let's say there's this light of grace has illumined your heart, that this daily life that we're living has an infinite value. You have an infinite value. And you're drawn to experience that. See, how can I not just live this life of infinite value and bear witness to it? How can I not just believe it has infinite value, but how can I experience directly for myself the infinite value of every breath and heartbeat? How do I do that? And I say, well, I can't do that. But I can assume the inner stance that offers the least resistance to the greatest event of experiencing it. This is where we left off. So we're together so far? So, here it is then where we have then the importance of daily prayer and daily meditation, like a daily quiet time. Because without prayer, this tends to be just a poetically beautiful way of looking at life. It's only when experience itself turns into this that we become it. As long as we stand back where we're thinking about it, we're just thinking about it. Thomas Merton once said, we don't need more people to write more books on prayer. He said, some people have a lot of books on prayer, and they sit at home sipping tea underlying beautiful passages. They just never close the book. And how, because when we pray, it's in our heart. You know what I mean? There's that immediacy within our heart where we turn in this kind of simple, childlike, vulnerable openness to open ourselves to this unexplainable intimacy is our daily way. And in that light, then, here's a passage from Merton as kind of insight into this contemplative way of prayer. This is Merton's Palace of Nowhere, page 128. Merton was a priest at the monastery, and he'd celebrate the Eucharist each day. Then the monastic tradition was that each priest would celebrate Mass alone, and one of the brothers or someone would serve the Mass. And so he's in the chapel of the novitiate at Gethsemane, and he'd celebrate Eucharist, and then he's sitting after Mass, like required prayer after Mass, and he writes this. Beauty of sunlight falling on a tall vase of red and white carnations and green leaves on the altar of the novitiate chapel. The light and dark, the darkness of the fresh crinkled flower, light warm and red all around the darkness. The flower is the same color as blood, but it is not in any sense whatsoever as red as blood, not at all. It is as red as a carnation, only that. This flower, this light, this moment, this silence, God is. Eternity. He passes, He remains. We pass, in and out. He passes, we remain. We are nothing, we are everything. He is in us, He is gone from us, He is not here. We are here in Him. All these things can be said, but why say them? The flower is itself. The light is itself. The silence is itself. I am myself. All perhaps illusion, but no matter. For illusion is the shadow of reality, and reality is the grace and gift that underlies these lights, these colors, this silence. Underlies, is that true? They are simply real. They themselves are His gift. Next text. Although I see the stars, I no longer pretend to know them. Although I have walked in those woods, how can I claim to love them? One by one, I shall forget the names of individual things. You who sleep in my breast are not met with words. But in the emergence of life within life and of wisdom within wisdom, you are found in communion, thou in me and I in thee and thou in them and they in me, dispossession within dispossession, dispassion within dispassion, emptiness within emptiness, freedom within freedom, I am alone, thou art alone, the Father and I are one. I'd like to reflect on this. Here's the image that I use of this, and I remember sharing this last time I was here. I'll share it again. And you can either do this literally or use it poetically to make the point. The spiritual practice would be to go to your room an hour before sunset, and your only intention is to be with God while it gets dark. That's the only your intention. You go for any other reason, you may or may not make it. If you go to your room to go to sleep, you may have insomnia. Go to your room to figure something out, maybe you won't be able to. But if you go to your room to be with God while it gets dark, it's a winner. You can't go wrong. Now, God's been with you now every night that it's gotten dark from the day you were born. This is the first time you decided to join God. And God's so excited to see you coming. He's like, wow, where have you been? What am I, chopped liver? What's wrong? I won't take it personally. I'm just glad to see you. That's all. Go to your room, close the door, take off your shoes. prop up some pillows on a wall facing an open window and sit on the floor. Put your head back against the wall and settle into it. 1 hour before sunset. And be resolved to sit there 1 full hour after it's completely dark. You're going to be there a while. A couple hours. Don't put on any How to Be with God While It Gets Dark mood music. Don't light any How to Be with God While It Gets Dark incense. Don't take with you your copy of How to Be with God While It Gets Dark and 3 Easy Lessons. So you put your head back against the wall and say, it's just me, Lord. And God silently says, well, it's just me. And sit that way in the unrelenting sovereignty of day's end. Do not fall asleep. If you start to fall asleep, sit up a little straighter. And do not run away in your head. See? Because you're bored. Grocery lists, agendas. Do not go away. Be right there. Be right there. See? And sit like that. And as the day lingers and wanes, you're a person alone in the dark, sitting like that. You're attaining nothing. You're overcoming nothing. You're not figuring anything out. There's no ulterior motive. There is no agenda. You can't justify it to anybody. You're not producing anything. You're not achieving anything. Someday in a nursing home, you may have a chance to practice this a lot. Think, well, why not get a head start on it? By the way, which is the holiness of nursing homes, by the way. They're like temples of liberation, a paradoxical liberation that nobody wants. The holiness of the place, really the poverty of it all. Especially if you have a loved one who's in there and you visit them. And sit like that. To 1 full hour after it's completely dark. You've been bored 10,000 times, frustrated 10,000 times. See? Had insights 10,000 times, been confused 10,000 times. See? Just waves and waves of a lot of nothingness and nothing to hold on to. And your room is dark. And in that darkness, look around your room. The shadowy outline of things. This may be the first time you've ever been in your own room, this like joining God in the way God's in the darkness of the room you fall asleep in. In the Contemplative Heart book, I have this image. I got this image. My aunt, my mother's sister, when she was a young girl, almost died. I forget what disease she had. There's a treatment for it now. I know it was diphtheria. I don't know what it was. Anyway, she was dying. And while she was having this in death, she said she saw fields of flowers, like fluorescent flowers. And they all knew her. They all knew her and were calling her name. Lucille, Lucille, Lucille. And she was running through the flowers. And when she came back, she was angry that she came back. And through that experience, really led her to become a nun. She entered the convent because of that. So I think that's where this comes from. But the poetic image is this. Imagine you're alone in the middle of the night. You're dying. You know that you're dying. You're powerless and your mind is lucid. And you turn and you look at the flowers on the windowsill, silhouetted in the moonlight. And they seem to know all about it. See, they seem to know all about it. It's a primitive, primordial, vast, abyss-like depth that permeates everything completely and renders fear groundless. Like that. And you breathe into it. And it takes you to itself. And sitting there in the darkness of your own room, your ego loses the ability to maintain itself on its own terms. And in some childlike, radical, vulnerable way, your heart opens wide to some unbearable nearness that permeate you through and through and through and through and through. And you don't know what to say. And you give yourself to it. Because from all eternity, it's giving itself to you. And that's homecoming. That's homecoming. Slowly get up, and without turning on any lights, take off all your clothes, get into bed, and go to sleep. Not a bad way to end a day, I'd say. It's a little glimpse of what it's like to go to sleep in a monastery every night. Really, they're designed for it. Now, what if I say to you, what do you think, you want to go try it? Usually here's the response, no. I'll pass. The lovely thought. Lovely thought, but woo yoy. Wow, you're kidding, right? No. But what if it tugs at your heart? It tugs at your heart, and there's something in you that knows exactly what I'm talking about. And your unconsummated longings is where an infinite love with infinite patience is waiting for you to surrender like that. To know what this is about is to know, paradoxically, that you are the light of the world. You are the light of the world. Because there is a light that doesn't shine from you, it shines through you. And it shines through you in your very emptiness. It has rendered you playful. It has rendered you childlike. You don't have any footing anymore in anything. You no longer pretend to explain anything at all. All you know is that every breath and heartbeat is more precious than words can say. No. Jesus says, you have eyes to see, but you do not see. That's the statement. See, there is your God-given godly nature of who you are in me before the origins of the universe, and you don't see it. But in the compassionate encounter, we can see mirrored back, as the Buddhists would say, our original face before we were born. Sometimes you can be in the presence of someone that you can tell sees in you a preciousness you're not yet able to recognize. And reflected in their eyes, you get a sense of your worth. Until little by little, you can see it too. This is the healing encounter. And therefore, you learn to live like someone in the world who is called to be with people like this. I, who have come to learn the infinite love that shines in my fragility, I can be with people in such a way that they might see in the way I treat them and talk to them, mirrored back to them, how precious they are in their fragility. And this is to be the light of the world that shines in the world like this. This is it. I think this is it, really. You know, really. And I'd now like to say a word about Teresa of Avila. How would that be? Teresa of Avila in 8 minutes. Just to bear witness here to another mystic. And here's Teresa of Avila. Just to bear witness to someone just for a few minutes. 16th century Spain. See, this is the ancient tradition of contemplative Christianity, going all the way back, really, to Jesus and his nights in prayer. Here's how Teresa puts it. Here's her language for it. She says, since we're created in the image and likeness of God, our soul can be compared to a castle. And the floor plan of your soul is the floor plan of heaven in miniature. It's a nice way to put it. That you take the boundaryless domain of heaven, and God has made the interiority of your own soul to be the interiority of heaven. The kingdom of heaven is within you. And this is who we are because God says so. This is the we are the light of the world. Next point she raises. Although we are this, this is not to say that we realize who God knows us to be. Because we can be living in ignorance of who we infinitely are, which is the unawakened heart. It's the life of the unawakened heart. It's the ego giving over to the illusion as nothing but itself. She says, then there's degrees of spiritual awakening. you're going along, there's just nothing but what I can see and touch and manage and my reactivity and all the rest of it. Then I have a breakthrough experience through 12-step program, through my faith, through in the arms of the beloved, through illness. It comes as it comes, and I'm awakened. So the first mansion is where a person first begins to discover the interiority of their own heart. There is all this out here, and here there's a rich withinness within there I didn't even know was there. And she says, you learn to get used to living like that. She says, when you're new at this, you have a divided heart. And so during the day, you're very devout and sincere. And at night, you sneak out for little escapades. Because you're not done fooling around with the things that keep you miserable. First mansion. She says, what happens when you got through the door into the first mansion, you were careless how you opened the door and reptiles got in with you. And they chase you around in there. Which are the habits of your heart formed in trauma and fear. The second mansion, you go a little deeper. You go a little bit deeper. And here she says, here's where you do your inner work. And here I would say, as a contemplative therapist, here's where depth psychology touches spirituality. Because here's where you realize the reptiles didn't sneak in. You're raising them as pets. So, in other words, you are mysteriously nursing and feeding the very things that torment your heart. Seriously. This is very deep right here. If the closest you got to having a father was a father who beat you, you will be drawn to someone who abuses you. So you can be fathered by abuse. If the closest you got to having a mother was a mother who turned a cold eye towards your needs in an unacknowledged emotional abandonment, you're mothered by abandonment by trying to find people who will abandon you. And if you can't find anybody to abandon you, you'll abandon yourself. You'll abuse yourself. And this is very intimate. See, how to let go of clinging so tightly to the things that torment me. And why is it so hard to let go of this? And you ask God for the grace. She says, the third mansion is you do your inner work and you kind of reach cruising altitude. Feel free to move about the cabin. And you're less chaotic than you used to be. You're more grounded than you used to be. You're more consistently loving than you used to be. You're more virtuous than you used to be. She says, but the trouble with the third mansion is that the reason has not yet been conquered by love. She says, it's entirely too reasonable. She says, people in the third mansion go sailing, but they're always careful to keep the land in view. See? You always get back to your ego to check off your checklist of your religious virtues. So you're still living on your own terms in the light of grace. She says, the fourth mansion, you're drawn to the prayer of quiet. She says, in the prayer of quiet, she says, usually the person, she says, you're sitting there in reflective prayer for your daily meditation, your spiritual reading. She says, you're interiorly moved not to say anything. You're interiorly moved not to think anything. You're interiorly moved to rest wordlessly in the presence of God beyond words. She's usually people close their eyes. She's usually the breathing gets very subtle. And you sit like that, like you're drawn to be very, very still. Like any movement of your ego would disrupt an immensely delicate transformation that's happening within your heart. In the fifth mansion, she says you kind of disappear from yourself. In silence, you disappear from your own observing eyes. Your finite eyes lose sight of what's happening to your heart. And she uses an example of a caterpillar that disappears in the cocoon, and you disappear in silence. You're sitting there in silence, and it's so empty, it's so subtle, there's a moment you vanish away from yourself. She says, when you come back, she says, maybe nothing happened. How do you know there were no witnesses? But you know something happened to you in the silence of your heart because you emerge as a butterfly with tattered wings. Everywhere you land, it's not enough for you. Everything suffers from not enoughness. You land here, you land here, you land here, you land here. She says, but you've never been more at peace in your whole life. She says, in the sixth mansion, she says, through rapture, infinite love translates your libido into itself. And she says, through visions, infinite knowledge translates your mind into itself. And you come to the seventh mansion, and I'll read the text. We might say that union, she speaks first of spiritual betrothal. Like, see, what I think is like is first we and God are casual friends. We meet every so often for a latte and chat. Next it gets a little closer and we're dating God. You know, we're dating. Kind of getting used to each other. Then it gets very, very serious and we're engaged. I'm engaged to God, see my ring. And then what it would be like to be married to God. That's what she said. Now God's always been married to you, see, the beloved. But now, see, to say you're about to vow yourself back to the love that vows itself to you. So first the spiritual betrothal. We might say that the light that we might say the soul remains all the time of that sun with itself. We might say that this union, as if two wax candles were joined, so that the light they give is one. The wick and the wax and the light are all one. Yet afterwards, the one candle can be perfectly well separated from the other, and the candles become two again, or the wicks may be withdrawn from the wax. So it goes like this. I'm living along my daily life. I have my daily prayer. And in the deep inner silence of my prayer, here's God's candle over here. My little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine over here. And in the silence, they get closer, closer, closer. And the two flames merge and they burn into one flame in silence. Until the damn cell phone goes off and they separate. In other words, at first, under optimal conditions, the flame burns as one. See? It's like this. You want to tell the people you live with, you know, I think really, if it wasn't for you, I could be a saint, honest to God. That it'd be like, I think I could really be mystical if I only didn't have to live my life. Or Lucy has a psychiatry booth set up. Psychiatry, 5 cents. Charlie Brown puts down the nickel. She says, Charlie, your problem is that you're you. He said, I know that. What do I do about it? She said, I don't solve problems. I just point them out. But what do we do? See, when we realize that God is hopelessly in love with the messy edges of your own broken heart. It isn't God's waiting for you to get your act together to grant you this union. God has already completely granted union in the unfinished business of your fragility. Then you're defenseless in the love that takes you to itself. It's like this. And then she says, this state of union, this abiding union, where even difficulties do not hinder it, because even God is the infinity of your difficulties. Even death doesn't hinder it, because God is the infinity of death, and you know it in your heart. You know that lovely story of Teresa, where she's crossing a river in a storm on one of her trips in a little wagon, and the storm of the wagon tips over and she falls in the mud. And she says, God, why are you letting this happen to me? He says, Teresa, this is the way I treat my friends. She says, no wonder you have so few. See, what does that mean to say that when in my difficulties, God's the infinity of my difficulties? In my obstacle to reach God, what if God is the infinity of my inability to reach God? That my very inability to reach God is God. What would that mean to come to that? For a person who's come to this state, it's like rain falling from the heavens into a river. There's nothing but water. And it is impossible to divide or separate the water belonging to the river from that which falls from the heaven. That is, that we and God simultaneously disappear as other than each other. And they disappear as other than each other in the ordinariness of our life. As Christians, we would say, this is how Christ lived. This is how Christ lived. This is what Christ realized with utter, complete clarity. And Christ also knew that the same is true of you as well, and that your sorrow is that you don't see it yet. And so to know that we are the light of the world, then, is really a language that harkens us back to this primitive wisdom of the mystical lineage of our own Christian faith. So, we have 5 minutes. We won't waste 30 seconds to stand and stretch, so we can take full opportunity of this. Any questions or concerns about this approach to life-related matters?
Thank you for that most beautiful expression of the divine. And here's my question. God is creator of everything. The creativity of the divine is awesome. So in every person, there seems to be a creative impulse. Like what you feel your soul's code is born to express, that feels to me different than my ego.
Right.
It can get mixed up with the ego very easily. But if it doesn't get mixed up with the ego, it feels one with the creative aspect of the divine as an expression in the world, unique to each person. So I'm wondering where this impulse of creativity relates to the mystic awareness of no self.
Yes. This is my sense of it, really. And here, because of few minutes left, I'll just respond in a brief way to a big question. Here's how Meister Eckhart, I'll use the language of Meister Eckhart. Meister Eckhart has this word, Gelassenheit. Gelassen. And you can see the etymology of the word lazy in Gelassenheit. Gelassen, lazen. And in effect, what Meister Eckhart says is that God is not at all uptight about being God. Like, God's very relaxed about being God. And God's so laid back about being God that God gives being God away as the ground of your own mind. This creative act, Eckhart says, God must do it. God must do it. The nature of the infinite is that infinity infinitely gives infinity away. Not as the act that God performs, but it's the act that God is. God is the act of infinity giving infinity away, and gives it away as us. Now, since God gives God away as the ground of our own mind, and without that giving away, we are nothing, absolutely nothing. This is not to say we're God. This is to say with God, we're absolutely nothing without God. And yet, paradoxically, we're nothing without God, yet paradoxically, who we are is all that God is, given to us in our nothingness. When we awaken to that, when we awaken to the generosity of God, God waits for the reciprocity of love, that we would give ourselves back to the infinite love that gives itself to us. And in that reciprocity of generosity is reality. That reciprocity is creativity. So here's how I put it, the way it makes sense for me to put it, the question you're raising, to echo Eckhart. Find that act, or find that person, or find that community, which, when you give yourself over to it with your whole heart, it unravels your petty preoccupation with your self-absorbed self. And in doing so, strangely brings you home to yourself, where you're most yourself in your origin. Find that person, find that community, find that act, which, when you give yourself over to it with your whole heart, it unravels your petty preoccupation with your self-absorbed self. And in doing so, strangely brings you home to yourself. It was once I was at a retreat once, and the priest there who presided at a liturgy, he was a missionary for years, and he'd come to the States for cancer treatments. And from a medical point of view, they were not successful. And he asked for his community for permission to go back and die in the village that he had lived in as a missionary for years. And he gave the homily, the mass. And you could tell by looking at him, he was very ill. And he spoke with profound gratitude for the people of that village who taught him how to live. Galasanite. See, that's creativity. That's creativity. There is that which calls you to give yourself to it because it gives itself to you. It's the person you're with, the community you're with, the holiness of the task at hand. And when you meditate, that's the act. And when you meditate with all your heart, it unravels your petty preoccupation with your self-absorbed self. And that reciprocity of endless creativity is the way, you might say. It's 12 o'clock, and I'm done.